This lecture is produced by Stone Kingdom Ministries of Asheville, North Carolina. Follow along in your Bible as James Brueggemann shares good news from God's Word. For a sample copy of our publication and a catalog of the resources available, write to Stone Kingdom Ministries, Post Office Box 5695, Asheville, North Carolina, zip code 28813. You may also visit us on the web at www.stonekingdom.org. Your regular financial support is what makes this ministry possible, and we are grateful to you for that. And now, here is Bible teacher James Brueggemann.
This is the second half of our message today, and I don't know what I'm going to put on the tape label as a title yet. You know, this is about the death of Absalom, so obviously the simple thing to put on there would be the death of Absalom, but, you know, he gets hung up in an oak tree at the end, so I'm thinking of Absalom's hang-ups. That's not bad. Ron was suggesting let's play darts, or hanging out at the old oak tree, or you know, something like that. Well, anyhow, I don't know what the title is, but we're in, His hairdo got him in trouble, that's right. We're in 2 Samuel 17 and verse 18. Now, we left off where the boys at En-Rogel, which were the sons of the two Kohai priests, were just given some intelligence info, and they were spotted. It says in verse 18, nevertheless, a lad saw them and told Absalom, but they went both of them away quickly and came to a man's house in Bahurim, which had a well in his court, whither they went down. Now, you might recall from our last lecture that stone-throwing Shimei, the Saul partisan, was from this town of Bahurim, which means village of young men. So, not all the men and women in Bahurim were Saul supporters. Verse 19 says, and the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and spread ground corn thereon, and the thing was not known. Does this incident remind you of another woman who hid two spies about 400 or 500 years earlier? Rahab? Yep. And where did she hide those two spies? Up on the roof, and then under flax, right? And what's made from flax? Linen. What does linen represent in the Bible? Righteousness. So being covered with flax, it symbolizes that the spies were clothed in righteousness. And flax is also symbolic of the overcomers because it's closely associated with the barley grain, because they both come to harvest early in the spring at the same time. They come in first. That's why one of the reasons the barley company represents the overcomers. It is harvested first. And barley is probably the preeminent symbol of the overcomers. Now observe the similarities in the case of David's two spies. Instead of being hid up on the roof, they are hidden way down below in a dry well. In the New Testament, churches should be bodies of believers where the water of the Word is plentiful and where it is ministered abundantly upon all believers. A living, vibrant, dynamic church is a well full of sweet water which sustains the spiritual life of its participants. So what would a dry well be? It would be a church that perhaps has all its form but no substance. A dead or dying church, if you will, where people are dying of spiritual thirst because there is no living water there, just a bunch of control doctrines and traditions of men. Perhaps the forms of a church are there. Perhaps there is land, buildings, and equipment. Perhaps they have 15 school buses for Sunday school and lots of activity. They can have all that and still be a dry well, can't they? How many of you have at one time or another been in churches like that? So here are David's two undercover agents who are now literally undercover in the dry well. It would be easy to overlook the fact that the woman spread the covering and it was spread with ground corn upon it. But this is highly significant, I do believe. And you won't find this in Strong's, but in deeper works we find that the ground corn actually means peeled barley. You know, about 12 years ago I did a series of 7 tapes on the significance of barley in the Bible. Obviously with 7 tapes there's a lot of material there, but to my delight, every once in a while I'm given some additional information about barley and its biblical significance. And I was talking with Doug Evers about this the other day because I knew that he knew about the processing of barley. His company also presses flax oil, by the way. He said that peeled barley is when the barley has the hulls taken off. Now, be thinking of this in types and shadows. Most of us have understood that the barley company overcomers seem to be blessed in that instead of having to be threshed like the wheat company in order to get the chaff separated, the barley company only needs to be winnowed. Winnowing is the process where the farmer takes the pitchfork and scoops underneath the barley stalks, throws it up in the air, and the wind, the Holy Spirit, gently blows away the chaff. It doesn't need to be threshed in order to get the chaff separated from the grain. I've cautioned us, though, that the barley company is not immune from pain and suffering. All prospective overcomers know that by experience, don't we? I've suggested that we will all go through the fire just as the wheat company. Both grains are baked in the ovens to make barley cakes or barley bread. It's what I think is the baptism of fire. You go through the fire now or you go through the lake of fire later. But what I want to share with you now is that after the barley has been winnowed, after the chaff has been separated from the grain, that there is another necessary process before it can be used for bread. The barley must be peeled. The hull must be removed. It's a process which today, Doug tells me, is called pearling the barley. Pearled barley. Now that's an interesting Bible word, isn't it? And how is the barley pearled? You're not going to like this. The barley is fed between 2 stones, 2 grindstones. And of course, to have barley flour, the grain must be further ground. So really, folks, no matter which company or when we are in, the barley, the wheat, or the grapes and olives, etc., there is some painful processing involved in each of them. But knowing this now, how many of you still want to go for the gold? How many of you still want to strive for the high calling of being overcomers? You having second thoughts, Ron? You want to think about it overnight? Yeah, indecision. Oh, there was a rapture. You're gone. You're left behind. All right, now, going back to Ahimaaz and Jonathan, these spies are part of David's company, right? So in type, they're part of the overcomer company. And what I see here is that sometimes overcomers are in very lowly positions. They were in the bottom of the dry well, weren't they? So sometimes overcomers are hidden in the churches doing janitor work or caring for the babies in the nursery. So there are overcomers in the dry well churches which have no life. But the good news is that not only are the overcomers covered with barley at the top of the dry well, but that the whole church is covered with barley, which speaks of the ultimate blessing of the whole church, because the barley, the peeled barley, the processed barley, provides their covering. We have talked about that also in great detail before, how the barley, in a sense, provides the covering for the wheat company. That was in our album on universal reconciliation. Sometimes, in times of persecution, the Saul leaders, the Absalom leaders, and their spiritual henchmen will seek out for to destroy those whom they deem to be their enemies, and they will not find them because they are right under their noses in their own churches. The overcomers are there in the dry wells doing undercover work. They're doing the stealth work, showing their love for the brethren in all that they do. I know that some of you who are part of our Atlanta fellowship do undercover work in other churches when I'm not here. And you are having an impact. I hope you know that. Praise Yahweh. Verse 20. And when Absalom's servants came to the house, to the woman, to the house, they said, "Where is Ahimaaz and Jonathan?" And the woman said unto them, "They be gone over the brook of water." And when they had sought and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem. So the similarity with Rahab and the spies continues. When the bad guys show up, Rahab lies and says, "They went that away." When Saul's SWAT team went to David's house to kill him, remember David's wife, Michal? She puffed up some pillows under the blankets and lied to the SWAT team saying, "David was sick, come back in the morning." But meanwhile, he had already scampered down through the window and headed for Saul's seminary. And now, here, when the Saul in town, Mr. Absalom, sends his SWAT team after David's spies, this woman lies and tells them, "They went that away." Are we seeing a pattern here? Verse 21. And it came to pass, after they were departed, that they came up out of the well, and went and told King David, and said unto David, "Arise, and pass quickly over the water, for thus hath Ahithophel counseled against you." Remember, the spies only had the knowledge of what Absalom had been counseled. He was indecisive, and therefore no one knew whether or not Absalom would perhaps follow Ahithophel's advice after all. 22. Then David arose and all the people that were with him, and they passed over Jordan. By the morning light there lacked not one of them that was not gone over Jordan. Notice how David did not suffer from indecisiveness. He acted immediately and thus saved all the people and ultimately his throne. 23. And when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass and arose and got him home to his house and to his city, and put his household in order, and hanged himself, and died, and was buried in the sepulcher of his father. One might be correct in surmising that Ahithophel also was a very proud man. He shared that with Absalom. That was Ahithophel's burden, his temptation to overcome. After all, when you have a reputation in the nation as being not only one of the best and brightest, but being so brilliant that when you speak, people have such awe for you that they say, it's as if God himself spoke. You might have a little problem with a puffed up head, right? Then when his advice to Absalom was so clearly wise, and yet it was rejected and deemed foolishness in comparison with Hushai's advice, well, Ahithophel might feel more than slighted, more than stung. He would feel deeply rejected. More than that, though, his wisdom also allowed him to realize that from a political and military standpoint, the ball game was over. Because Absalom had dilly-dallied in making a decision to go after David, the element of surprise in catching David and his group in disarray was totally forfeited. Ahithophel now knew for certain that the attempted coup would end abortively, and that when David returned, that Ahithophel would be executed as the traitor that he was. Much like King Saul falling on his own sword on Mount Gilboa because he could not bear to be disgraced, so Ahithophel, being so proud, could not bear the thought of being disgraced publicly and publicly executed, so he took his own life by hanging. 1,000 years later, the antitype of Ahithophel was played out in the person of Judas Iscariot. Judas had been part of Jesus' inner circle, but Judas had these fantasies of the Savior leading the Judah nation to a great and glorious military victory over the oppressive Roman government. And Judas also had this problem with the love of money. He was, in fact, the treasurer for Jesus and the disciples. And so probably in an attempt to force Jesus to get started with the rebellion and lead them to victory, Judas betrayed the greater David for 30 pieces of silver. And now I read to you from Matthew 27:3. Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he, Jesus, was condemned, repented himself, and brought again the 30 pieces to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned in that I have betrayed the innocent blood. You see, Judas was full of remorse and regret when he saw that Jesus was not going to put up a fight. When he saw Jesus was actually going to let himself be executed, this shocked Judas inside himself. He's now panicking. Wait, Jesus, you're supposed to do one of those miracles I've seen you do. Why, even in the garden last night when I brought the soldiers to take you, you just spoke a word and they all fell down backwards. You're supposed to kill them with a wave of your hand. And then we'll drive out these cursed Romans from our land. That's what the Messiah is supposed to do. Jesus, Jesus, you're not following my plan. No, but Jesus was following the plan. And so when Judas realized the awful truth, he tried to renege on the deal. He tried to trade back the 30 pieces of silver for Jesus, but it was a no-go. He tried to explain it was all a big mistake, verse 4b, and they said, what's that to us? See thou to that. And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself, just as the traitor Ahithophel had done, so did Judas. 2 Samuel 17:24. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom passed over Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. We've got the other map now. Here was that border I was telling you about between Benjamin and Judah, where En-Rogel is located. It's not pointed out here. And so what it's saying is that David went, he had been across, or hightailed it across Jordan here, the Jordan River, and went up to Mahanaim, which I wrote in here myself. This is the Ammonite territory here, so it's right on the border of Ammon. And it says Absalom crossed the Jordan into the plain of Gilead here. Mahanaim means two camps. Remember General Abner and King Ishbosheth after Saul died? Mahanaim is the place where Ishbosheth reigned from for several years over the 10 tribes of Israel, while David reigned over Judah from Hebron, which is misplaced. These are not very accurate maps. They're good for Sunday school, but Hebron is actually straight south of Jerusalem about there. So the name Two Camps was really symbolic of what happened at the time of Ishbosheth, because the nation was divided into two camps. Not only that, but it presaged the split of the kingdom after the death of Solomon into those same two camps, the 10 tribes and the 2 tribes. However, the very first incident recorded about Mahanaim is when Jacob was returning from his many years of service to his father-in-law Laban, 132, right? Remember how he was very fearful that Esau might still be angry with him after these 20, 21 years, and when he came back, that Esau might still be seeking to kill him? Well, as he came to this place, Mahanaim, he saw a bunch of angels, and he declared this was God's host, or God's army. And so he named the place Mahanaim, two camps, which can be taken in a number of different ways, because there was Jacob's camp and Esau's camp. There was Jacob's host and the angelic host. And as he prepared to meet Esau, Jacob divided his entire entourage into basically two camps. There were Zilpah and Bilhah, his two concubines, the maidservants of his two wives, Leah and Rachel. He took them and their sons and part of the property and put them out front, and then Leah and Rachel and their sons and other parts of the property he kept closer to himself. All of this he did out of fear of his enemy Esau. And then it was upon that very night when Jacob wrestled with the angel, which I believe was a theophany of the Lord Jesus Christ himself. But Jacob didn't know that, at least at first. Jacob very likely thought, at least for a time, that it was Esau who had snuck into the camp and was attacking him in the middle of the night. And they wrestled all night. But you see, Jacob was operating from a mindset of fear. And it was only when he saw God in Esau that he overcame. What I mean by seeing God in Esau is not to say that Esau was a godly man. Think of this in types and shadows. You know who Esau represents, or who is Esau. So Seeing God in Esau is not to say that Edomites are good. But seeing God in Esau is very much akin to what we saw in our previous lecture, how David saw God speaking through his enemy, Shimei. Remember how Shimei was stoning David, kicking dust as he passed by in the ravine? Can we see God's hands in the actions of our enemies toward us? It was that very night when Jacob wrestled with the Lord, thinking it was Esau, finally seeing God in Esau. That was the night when he overcame. That was when the angel declared to him that henceforth he would be named Israel. So Jacob Israel had experienced a new revelation, a life-changing revelation. When we see the hand of God in all our enemies, it will also be a life-changing revelation for us. That's the revelation which enables us to love our enemies. Can you hear what I'm saying? That's a hard one. Love our enemies. If you've never seen God in your enemy, pray God for that grace. Verse 25. And Absalom made Amasa captain of the host instead of Joab, which Amasa was a man's son whose name was Ithra, an Israelite, that went in to Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister to Zeruiah, Joab's mother. So if you have the handout I gave out in the first half of the message, the handout of David's family tree, and for those of you on the tape ministry, if you're looking at it also now, we can add some more to it, though there is some debate about the exact relationships. First, realize that David already had a person named Abigail in his life, didn't he? We've come across one of the wives was named Abigail. But now we have Abigail, who is the mother of General Joab and General Amasa, who is David's sister, probably half-sister. The text says she was a sister to Zeruiah. It doesn't say she was a sister to David. And therefore, we conclude that this Abigail and Zeruiah were daughters of David's mother, but fathered by the man named Nahash, not by Jesse. Note that it says that Ithra had gone into Abigail. This is another way of saying that he seduced her, and it means that Amasa was therefore born out of wedlock. Legitimate or not, Amasa is then David's nephew, and he's a first cousin to Joab and Abishai. Just as important, though, is that Amasa is first cousin of Absalom. Keep your marker where it's at, and let's look at 1 Chronicles chapter 2, if you would turn there, please. Because we want to explore this Ithra fellow further. Because normally, in the scriptures, one does not find individual men identified as an Israelite, like we just read here, because that's usually assumed to be the case. 1 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 13, it's the genealogy of David. And Jesse begat his firstborn Eliab, and Abinadab the second, and Shimma the third, Nethaneel the fourth, Radii the fifth, Ozem the sixth, David the seventh, 16, whose sisters were Zeruiah and Abigail, and the sons of Zeruiah, Abishai and Joab, and Asahel, three, and Abigail bare Amasa, and the father of Amasa was Jether the Ishmaelite. Jether is another form of Ithra, but here it identifies him as an Ishmaelite, and that would make more sense than in 2 Samuel 17. In other words, it should have been written, no doubt was in the original, as Ithra the Ishmaelite, not Israelite. You can turn back to 2 Samuel 17. So Absalom followed Hushai's advice and gathered a huge force from all the tribes of Israel. It must have taken several days, if not weeks, to amass that army with General Amasa at its head. Oh, I'm sorry, with Absalom, the wannabe king, at its head. Verse 26. So Israel and Absalom pitched in the land of Gilead. And it came to pass when David was come to Mahanaim that Shobi, the son of Nahash of Rabbah of the children of Ammon, and Machir, the son of Amiel of Lodabar, and Barzillai the Gileadite of Rogalim, brought beds and basins and earthen vessels, and wheat and barley, and flour and parched corn, and beans and lentils, and parched pulse. Pulse is, of course, not in the original, but added in there, but I think correctly. and honey and butter and sheep and cheese of kine for David and for the people that were with him to eat, for they said, the people is hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. Here's the providence of God at work, preserving David and all his company in their forced flight into the wilderness. It's certainly noteworthy that once again, just as David had found succor from King Achish of the Philistines during his flight from King Saul, so now David finds succor from another stranger in his flight from Absalom. And here the stranger is none other than an Ammonite, one of those peoples with whom Israel was forbidden to intermarry. Recall from our lecture, I think it was the one entitled The Wars of David, that after Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, died, that David sent ambassadors to pay their respects, but Nahash's son, Hanan, cut off half their beards and then cut off their garments to the waist, which means that it left their buttocks exposed and they had to go in public heading back to their own country with their buttocks exposed. But after Joab conquered the Ammonites, it's probable that David appointed Hanan's brother, Shobi, as the new king, and was generous to Shobi in granting him a great measure of self-government, as long as they paid their tribute to the treasury of Israel. And so it's quite likely that Shobi is now remembering this kindness and is gladly lending assistance to David in this hour of need. Now, we need to remember these things as we have relationships with those not of our own kind. Let David, in his righteous acts, be our guide and model. 2 Samuel 18:1. And David numbered the people that were with him, and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. Thousands? I wonder if David had that many men, plus their families, that fled Jerusalem. I guess it's possible. But I think it's also possible that some of the people in the area of Mahanaim, both of the Israelites and perhaps even Shobi, lent David some of his Ammonite troops to help quell the rebellion of Absalom. Doesn't say that, but it's a possibility. Shobi probably knew Absalom, at least by reputation, and he knew that he and his Ammonites were much better off with David on the throne than with Absalom. Regardless of the composition of the army, in typical Hebrew military strategy, it says, David separated the army into three parts. Verse 2, and David sent forth a third part of the army under the hand of Joab, and a third part under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and a third part under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said unto the people, I will surely go forth with you myself also. And one would have to surmise that this Philistine of Gath, Ittai, surely worshipped the God of Israel as well. We covered that last time. So David is ready to lead the troops out to battle. 3. But the people answered, Thou shalt not go forth, for if we flee away, they will not care for us, neither if half of us die will they care for us. But now thou art worth 10,000 of us, therefore now it is better that thou succor us out of the city. And the king said unto them, What seemeth you best I will do. And the king stood by the gate side, and all the people came out by hundreds and by thousands. And the king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, Deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom. So the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was in the wood of Ephraim, where the people of Israel were slain before the servants of David, and there was there a great slaughter that day of 20,000 men. I know I've mentioned this in a message or two many years ago, but I told how I was so moved when I visited two of the most bloody battlefields of our own Civil War, Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Antietam, Maryland. While in those museums, just looking at the big, what do they call them, dioramas, big scale models that they've got of the whole battlefield, and they got the troop placements so you can visualize the whole thing, where the troop concentrations were, how they moved against each other, how they slaughtered each other, and then you go out and drive through the actual battlefield and stop and listen to a recording, you read the plaques. I mean, it's an extremely intense emotional experience, and when you stop at the actual locations, you can almost see it playing, you know, as you look out over the meadow or the woods or whatever. And it was at Antietam where on September 17, 1862, that 87,000 Union troops confronted not more than 40,000 Confederates under General Robert E. Lee, and there were 21,000 killed in one day. And it ended in a draw in that case. Well, then here in our text, we look at one of our people's ancient civil wars where David's troops routed Absalom's armies with almost the same number killed in one day. What great tragedy. What great folly. All brought about because of the pride of one man who thought he could rule better than his father. Verse 8. For the battle was there scattered over the face of all the country, and the wood devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. What that means is that the terrain was so rugged, it was so full of ravines and craggy precipices and marshes, that the fighting was made all the more difficult, and the advantage was therefore to go to David's veterans as opposed to Absalom's draftees. The land was also heavily wooded with huge oak trees and terebinth trees, and obviously the Forest Service had not kept up with the tree trimming, so that many thick branches remained low on those huge oak trees. And this led to great confusion among the draftees, and many were probably going in circles and were eventually killed by David's veterans. And thus, when David's skilled troops began to cut down Amasa's inexperienced draftees rather early in the battle, it's quite likely that they and their cowardly King Absalom panicked and decided to beat a quick retreat back to the Jordan. But just like his troops had been, Absalom's retreat had been cut off. Verse 9. And Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode upon a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great oak, and his head caught hold of the oak, and he was taken up between the heaven and the earth, and the mule that was under him went away. How many of you have seen the children's picture Bibles where it shows Absalom hanging there by his long hair, having been snarled in a tree? Most of you have seen that. Well, chances are his hair was tucked up inside his helmet. I believe his head was literally caught in the fork of tree branches. And as he tried to lift up his arms to free himself, the mule moved on. It doesn't say it was his hair. It says his head was caught up. Verse 10, and a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, Behold, I saw Absalom hanged in an oak. And Joab said unto the man that told him, And behold, thou sawest him, and why didst thou not smite him there to the ground? And I would have given thee 10 shekels of silver and a girdle. Now, the girdle was a finely wrought leather belt and combination money pouch, which was given as a great honor in those days, and it usually signified a person who had just been promoted from the enlisted ranks to become an officer. So it was highly valued. Verse 12, And the man said unto Joab, Though I should receive 1,000 shekels of silver in mine hand, yet would I not put forth mine hand against the king's son. For in our hearing the king charged thee and Abishai and Ittai, saying, Beware that none touch the young man Absalom. Otherwise I should have wrought falsehood against mine own life. For there is no matter hid from the king, and thou thyself wouldest have set thyself against me. Pretty smart fellow, isn't he? So in addition to doing the right thing, he wasn't stupid. Had he killed Absalom, Joab could have pretended like he certainly would never have approved of killing him. But now Joab takes matters into his own hands. Verse 14. Then said Joab, I may not tarry thus with thee. And he took 3 darts in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. Now these darts would be short, sharpened sticks, and for some reason they penetrated his chest cavity, but he was still alive. I don't get it, but anyhow, that's what it says. Verse 15, and 10, count them, young men that bare Joab's armor compassed about and smote Absalom and slew him. So Absalom dies in the oak tree. This is highly significant, and we will come back to that in a moment, but let's first deal with the fact that Joab expressly disobeyed King David's orders in not bringing Absalom back alive. One's first thought is,
Why, that terrible and cruel man, Joab. But there's another side of this. You see, Joab was as politically savvy as he was military savvy. And he realized that if Absalom were not executed, David's throne would never be safe. David was soft. Perhaps, no, there's no perhaps about it. He was weak when it came to dealing with his own children. And we've seen that weakness in great men time after time after time in the scriptures. From Jacob dealing with his sons, to Judah and his sons, to Eli the high priest dealing with Hophni and Phinehas, and other examples. Well, David is no different in this respect. He is soft and weak in that area of his character. And Joab rightly fears that David will ultimately and very foolishly pardon Absalom and thus endanger the throne once again. But David thinks Absalom, he's just a boy who's made some bad choices. Moreover, what Joab might have taken for David's leniency may in fact have been David's knowledge of his own guilt, which has been the root cause of all these events prophesied long ago by Nathan. But Joab knows Absalom for what he is, a proud megalomaniac with a lust for power and no real love for people that he pretends to wish to serve. Joab therefore knows that he himself will have to suffer the consequences for this deliberate act of disobedience in killing Absalom, but that in doing so, Joab is actually putting the welfare of the nation above his own personal safety for disobeying King David. Now, all of that having been said, Joab was not lily white in this either. As usual, it's a mixed bag. Because he undoubtedly harbored a grudge and a desire for vengeance ever since Absalom angered and humiliated Joab by burning his barley field. Remember that? And Joab is the type of man who seeks revenge. Remember how cunningly he assassinated General Abner after Abner had unwillingly killed Joab's brother Asahel? One also has to suspect that God was meting out justice to Absalom very fittingly when 10 of Joab's armor-bearers finished him off, which could be seen as balancing the Absalom ravishing the 10 concubines. Yeah, it's an eye for an eye. In verse 6, it tells us that this battle ranged over a large territory, and it's described as occurring in the forest of Ephraim. Where is that? Well, no one knows for sure. There are some who think that there must have been a forested area on the east side of the, here's the Jordan, on the east side of the Jordan River. There must have been some forest here named the Forest of Ephraim. And, of course, the reasoning is that David was staying over here in Mahanaim, and it does say that Absalom crossed the Jordan. But that's not proof positive. It was days, before all this was over. They could have gone back and circled around. He could have heard about it. They could have gone back around that way. So there's no real way to know for sure, because there are other scholars that make an excellent case for the forest of Ephraim being actually in the territory of Ephraim here on the west of Jordan. And we don't have time to go into all the evidence for that, but if that were the case, then a very fascinating and significant connection is possible. As Ron Oja and I have discussed the Saul and David scenarios over many months, Ron has told me that he believes that the oak tree where Absalom died is the very place, if not the very oak tree, where Rebekah's nurse Deborah died. I'm going to sketch a few of the broad outlines of the significance of that here, and then when Ron speaks later this afternoon, if he wishes, he can fill in another 350,000 or so details and coincidences, give or take.
Not enough.
And to think, some people call me Mr. Detail. Let's read some of the background first. Let's go back to Genesis 31. As we pick up the story in verse 29 of Genesis 31, Jacob and his family have fled Laban. It's now a few days later, and Laban has caught up with Jacob, and he's telling Jacob how lucky he is that God is preventing him from kicking Jacob's hinder part all the way back to Canaan land. And Laban says here in Genesis 31:29, "It is in the power of my hand to do you hurt. But the God of your father spake unto me yesternight, saying, Take thou heed that thou speak not to Jacob either good or bad. And now, though thou wouldest needs be gone, because thou sore longest after thy father's house, yet wherefore hast thou stolen my gods? So Laban appears to be more upset about losing some little carved idols than he is about anything else. Why did you steal them? He asked Jacob. Now, of course, Jacob didn't know that Rachel had made off with these false gods, but he answers Laban thusly, verse 31. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid, for I said, peradventure thou wouldest take by force thy daughters from me. With whomsoever thou findest thy gods, let him not live. Before our brethren discern thou what is thine with me, and take it to thee. For Jacob knew not that Rachel had stolen them. And Laban went into Jacob's tent, and into Leah's tent, and into the two maidservants' tents, but he found them not. Then went he out of Leah's tent, and entered into Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the images, and put them in the camel's furniture, and sat upon them, and Laban searched all the tent, but found them not. Let me pause here just a moment to explain that the camel's furniture referred to here is a rather large basket-type compartment, often with a little shade roof over it, which was fitted to the camel's back, and in which Rachel had been riding. And there was a place under the seat cushion where, you know, like a hidden compartment, I guess you could say. Verse 35, and she said to her father, let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise up before thee, for the custom of women is upon me. And he searched, but found not the images. So to summarize, Rachel's the one who stole the teraphim, they're called, the false gods, the idols, and she'd hid them under her seat. Her father has searched everywhere, and so he comes to her, and she says, excuse me, Dad, I can't get up, you know, because I'm on my period. Pretty good reason, right? And because the custom was, you rise in the presence of your elders. Laban goes home without finding the idols. Jacob and his large and growing family then journey on to Mahanaim, where Jacob prepares to meet his feared adversary brother Esau. He wrestles with the angel, gets a name change, meets Esau, and then he tells him in Genesis 33, verse 10, please turn to Genesis 33, verse 10, very important verse. Genesis 33:10, and Jacob said, he's talking to Esau, nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand, for therefore I have seen thy face as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. So, see the face of God in your enemy. After the encounter with Esau, Jacob and company move on across Jordan to the west, where Jacob buys a portion of a field near the place later called Shechem. And next, Jacob's daughter, Dinah, is raped by the Hivite prince named Shechem. And that's right here, by the way, just north of the territory of Ephraim, of course, west of the Jordan. Now go to Genesis 35, verse 1. Because after that rape of Dinah, Simeon and Levi then slaughter all the men of Shechem's city. And at that point, God puts in a phone call to Jacob and says, Jake, I think you and the boys better hit the road again. Some angry people. So Genesis 35, 1, and God said unto Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make there an altar unto God that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother. Then Jacob said unto his household and to all that were with him, put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments. New Testament times, put away your strange gods, get baptized, put on the righteousness of Christ. All right, so here are these idols again. And apparently Rachel is not the only one with these little buggers. Idolatry has become widespread among Jacob's family. And so Jacob, Israel, now demands that they turn over the false gods to him. Verse 3, and let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and was with me in the way which I went. And they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all their earrings which were in their ears, And Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. Under the oak. So remember, the idols are buried under the oak tree. Verse 5, and they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. And Jacob came to Luz, L-U-Z, Luz, which is in the land of Canaan, that is Bethel, or Bethel, right there, used to be named L-U-Z. He and all the people that were with him, and he built there an altar and called the place El Bethel, because there God appeared unto him when he had fled from the face of his brother. And now, seemingly out of nowhere, with no connection to anything else in the story, comes verse 8. But Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried beneath Bethel under an oak. And the name of it was called Alon Bakuth, which means oak of weeping, oak of many tears. The fact is, there is no other mention by name in the Bible of this Deborah, who was Jacob's mother's nurse. Jacob's mother's nurse. Furthermore, since Jacob had left Isaac and his mother Rebekah 20-some years earlier, we've not even had a mention of Rebekah herself. So why did the Holy Spirit inspire that this statement should be entered into the Holy Writ? Right here. Perhaps it could be the connection between the idols, the oak trees, and death. Absalom, who is another picture of the Saul church, dies at an oak tree. The idols, the false gods in the family of Israel, are buried beneath an oak tree, and Deborah is buried under an oak tree at Bethel. And the burial of the idols and the burial of Deborah at Bethel occur just before Rachel dies in labor, giving birth to Jacob's youngest son, Benjamin. And remember, Benjamin is the only one of the 12 sons who was born an Israelite. All the others were born before he got the name change. Remember, the name change from Jacob to Israel signified Jacob's spiritual growth to a type of the overcomers. So, the Saul church's main problem has always been pride and idolatry. Can all these connections with the oak tree then symbolize the death of pride and idolatry in the church? Because Bethel means the house of God. Rachel herself is a picture of the church. You see, Rachel, the church, was sitting on the false gods. They were hidden in the church, weren't they? Hid under her seat. The Catholics like to claim that the seat of the church is Rome. You can figure out the rest of the story. Most of us know how Rome at the time of Constantine began importing the idolatry of Babylon's mystery religions into the Christian church, and it's been there ever since. The false gods in the church, all Christian churches, have to be put away. The pride of Saul and Absalom, the pride in the church has to die before Benjamin, the Israelite overcomer, can come forth. Godspeed the day. Amen.